Uh-oh, my engineer is giving me a sign that we're going to go live. I'm so sorry.
I'll sit and wait.
On the throat. He's giving me the throat cut thing, looking at me. All right, Sam. All right, here we go.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on my couch, as you always are, on Fridays, 11 in the morning Pacific Standard Time, in beautiful, Los Angeles, California. I always laugh at that. If you come here, you'll know why. Welcome to the irreverent, entertaining, and cool LA Talk radio station. We're always on the couch. You learn things about you and other people around you. And specifically, we're talking today about misunderstanding mental illness and some of the fascinating stories shared by my special guest. So he's one of my favorite guest experts and authors, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, who, in addition to running his private practice, has developed an interest in forensic psychology. He taught psychiatric residents, interns, psychologists, and social workers at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and became a clinical assistant professor at Cornell University's medical school. And by the way, just last week in Huffington Post, I don't know if you guys checked this out, but Dr. Rubenstein wrote a detailed and informative article entitled Madness and Death. And it's about how we address mental health as a society, and you know, how we can get a little more serious about adequately funding mental health clinics, and especially training our police officers so lethal force is not used against a lot of folks who on 911 calls pose no danger to others. They just don't understand the mentally ill. And I'm not blaming the cops, and we'll talk about that too. I'm just saying, not enough training and education has been done. Anyway, guys, you've got to check out that particular article. So along with being published for his brilliant psychiatric work, Dr. Rubenstein has also authored a lot of fiction and nonfiction books. Now, we've talked about these on the air. If you're a couch fan, as I call you, you've heard him talk about Mad Dog House, his book, Love Gone Mad, one of my favorites, The Foot Soldier, Mad Dog Justice, Return to Sundara, The Lover's Tango, other books as well that he co-authored. And his latest that we're talking about today. Now, this could be probably, no, I don't know if it's my, well, it's right up there in my all-time favorites that you've written. Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope. And, of course, the word bedlam is defined as a scene of uproar, confusion, pandemonium, mayhem. So what we're talking about is a journey from the open door of a psychiatric emergency room to the underground of a maximum security prison. And, of course, Dr. Rubenstein shares a lot of the psychiatric experiences that he has with patients, has had with patients. Fascinating reading, so let's get right to it. Mark, thank you so much for calling into the show.
Thank you, Dr. Michelle. Thanks for having me on your program.
You know, I always, you're so welcome. Whenever I have you on the show, I always think, wow, there's so much to be said about you and what you've done. The introduction is just, you know, requires about 10 minutes here. So,
well, I was going to say, are you talking about me?
Yes, that's right. You talking about me? So the latest book, A Bedlam's Door, True Stories of Madness and Hope. Actually, this is hope we're talking about. And it is a hopeful book. So on that, can you just kind of talk about why you think it was important for you to write this book?
Sure, Michelle. In a very real sense, I began writing this book perhaps 30 years ago. All of the stories are people about people I treated, and the ones that are in this book just remained with me over the years, to one extent or another. I've always thought and said that psychiatry is unlike any other medical specialty under the sun. I don't palpate abdomens. I don't listen to people's lungs or hearts. I don't look down their throats. Right. When people come to me, many of them are willingly visiting me. Sometimes it's involuntary, as was the case when I worked in hospitals, or in some instances when I did forensic evaluations. And they really ended up, in fairly short order, providing me with the most intimate details about their lives and their treatments, mm-hmm. their experiences.
Yeah.
And what that taught me was that most of the time, not always, but I'd say in the vast majority of instances, even the most baffling and strange symptoms and presentations could be very well understood if I spent time with the person and if I paid attention.
Mm.
And I was always struck by what really amounted to the fact that people, for the most part, are frightened when they encounter someone who's mentally ill or exhibiting signs and symptoms, and they shy away. And that led me to really compiling these stories, not just the stories, but also some explanations about what was going on and why. And I figured I wanted to share these stories with the general reading public and perhaps demystify some of the psychiatric issues involved.
You know, it's great reading. Bedlam Store, True Tales of Madness and Hope. What's going on, folks, is the book is broken down into 14 case studies. It's each chapter. And then there's a glossary of terms so you can, you know, get a better understanding of particular disorders. And what I understand is the way it rolled out is that your case studies started when the patient was admitted or, you know, the first time you met them in the hospital. Or your office, and then kind of went
usually
through
there. I named it Bedlam's Door because for a while I was a resident and I worked, among other locations, in an emergency room, in the largest psychiatric emergency room in the nation, Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn, New York, which, believe it or not, processed 80,000 patients a year at the time I was there.
Wow.
80,000. And at other emergency facilities as well, and I also worked on the wards and then eventually went into private practice and also taught at, as you mentioned, at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital and Cornell Medical Center. Back then it was called New York Hospital, Cornell Medical Center. But I supervised and taught and was the chief attending psychiatrist at both the downstate Kings County psychiatric emergency room and also in what was called the CES, the Central Evaluation System at Cornell Medical School. So I had vast exposure to emergency room experiences and situations, as well as, you know, my private patients and other patients on wards.
Wow. So what I'm so impressed about you, among many things, Dr. Rubenstein, is that, you know, you are a psychotherapist, a psychologist, and a psychiatrist. You do a lot of psychodynamic, psychoanalytic. You worked with patients one-on-one, and of course you're a medical doctor. You can prescribe meds, but your thing was, let's work on this on these people in therapy. And sure, we can throw the meds, which will, you know, mellow out some of the symptoms going on, but let's work through these minds and help these people. So,
absolutely. You know, understanding what's going on and the whys and wherefores is far more important than just suffocating symptoms because the vast majority of patients, particularly those who are psychotic, will at some point, for one or another reason, discontinue taking the medications or be in a situation where they can't get to them or because of the quirks in our medical delivery system won't have enough medications available or can't afford them and so forth. And these people's symptoms will return. But if you can develop an understanding and have them understand what's going on, particularly in the not dangerously psychotic people and those who may become depressed again and again, although certainly depression can become very dangerous to the self, they can get out of the fix that they're in with a good deal of understanding about what it is and why they've sunk to the depths that they have.
Mm-hmm.
I've always found that it's more valuable for a patient to develop understanding, insight, as we sometimes term it, as opposed to just smothering symptoms with medication, snowing patients with medicines that can give them many side effects, turn them into the walking dead, and so forth. So, you know, the future is very bright because they're developing newer and better medications with fewer and even no side effects, and other, well, I think we may have talked last time about the prospects for gene therapy in those very serious psychiatric and psychological illnesses.
But
the bottom line is, understanding at this point in time is really the key to getting past the illness.
Right. And speaking, you nailed it. And speaking about understanding, as I mentioned to you at the top of the show, I really want to have you back on the show again to talk more about your article. It was just came out last week, guys, in the Huffington Post, entitled Madness and Death. And you're addressing that as a society that we have to get serious about adequately funding mental health clinics, training our police officers, so they don't use lethal force against mentally ill people and can better understand. So with that in mind, maybe you could briefly chat about some of the misconceptions about mental illness that you feel, you know, the general public, and we talked about the fear at the beginning of the show, but law enforcement and even mental health practitioners should know and understand a little bit more.
You're right on target there. When I'm asked about misconceptions about mental illness, there are many, but there are three major ones that are somewhat different but very much related to each other. First of all, mentally ill people are not really terribly different from the rest of us.
Yeah.
As I said before, nobody would shun or avoid someone because of diabetes or heart disease. But people are just scared to death by the prospect of having anything to do with someone who's acting in a bizarre way, who presents with a psychiatric illness, particularly if the person's behavior seems bizarre and incomprehensible. The second thing that really is a vast misconception is really brought about and promulgated by recent events that occur with alarming frequency. Things like school shootings, mass killings in theaters, as happened in Aurora, Colorado, schizophrenic young man, James Holmes, killings in malls and disturbed people threatening police or pushing someone, as recently happened in New York City, in front of an oncoming subway car. These kinds of incidents, as rare as they may be, when you think about the general population of 330 million Americans, they bring public attention in the most horrifying way to this very small subset of people who are highly disturbed. And again, it's a small subset who are violent and who are mentally ill. And many of these people suffer from schizophrenia, but it should be emphasized that the vast majority of schizophrenics are not prone to violence. The third misconception, which is all kind of woven into this, it is that the mentally ill, the severe mentally ill, are beyond the pale and can't be helped. They should be locked away as they used to be years ago in insane asylums, in so-called sanatoriums. The diagnosis of schizophrenia with proper care, with proper medication, with proper treatment at regular intervals, in whether it's a community-based mental health center or private practice, these kinds of illnesses are very amenable to treatment. They are completely within the bounds of treatment, and any potential violent outbursts can, for the most part, be absolutely avoided and obviated by this kind of treatment. So these three misconceptions sort of work in concert with each other and keep the general public either misinformed or frightened about what mental illness portends and what to do with mentally ill people.
Wow, you nailed it. And also, what's fascinating to me is I watch some of these ID shows and, of course, social media and news programs. And like you said, these rare occurrences in individuals are accentuated and really cause a lot of terror, you know, in society and misconceptions about really what's going on. So I think, you know, the media drives all that fear as well, which is not good, but...
Well, yeah, you know, only, I believe it was yesterday, the young man who killed nine people in a church was found guilty of many, many federal offenses, you know, everything from premeditated murder to gun law violations and so forth. I have not obviously interviewed him or seen him live and in person, but I would guarantee you that if you look... in the penalty phase of his trial, I'm sure it's going to come out that he is highly disturbed, as are most of these people who commit these atrocious crimes, whether it's James Holmes in Aurora, Colorado, or any of the other mass shootings that have occurred over the past number of years, and all too frequently with social media and the media at large, the mainstream media, these things become instantly publicized, and they are available on YouTube, and it gets promulgated and becomes mythologized.
Right, exactly. It really does. And of course, you're not saying it's okay, and you know, it's, you know, these people are mentally ill, so we're going to give them a pass. No, goodness, no. But you know, if you're understanding those voices that are talking to them, saying everyone else is the devil, and you've got to, you know, they think they're doing it for a good cause. You know, you are the son of God.
I once evaluated a patient at the request of the courts in Connecticut who had stabbed to death his own six-year-old daughter because he thought she was the embodiment of the devil. Well, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. It's called NGRI, not guilty by reason of insanity. But another common misconception is that if a defendant is found not guilty, NGRI, that he, quote-unquote, got away with murder.
Right.
And that's not at all true.
No,
Being found guilty by reason of insanity, not guilty by reason of insanity, means that the individual is mandated automatically to a state hospital for the so-called criminally insane, and this is a mandatory situation. And the statistics are very compelling. The average length of stay, such as for the young man who was just released on home release after having shot President Reagan in 1981. Okay. The average stay is 32 years.
There you go.
And the average stay in a mental hospital for that kind of violence prone psychotic individual is far longer than would the stay have been for someone who had been found guilty by the legal system and sentenced to prison.
Oh, gosh, you're so, right.
That's a vast misconception that
really
people say, oh, he got away with it. He did not guilty by reason of insanity.
Right. I encountered one of those patients as well when I was working in a hospital years ago, a very high-functioning person, professor, you know, had the voices. And the good news is the child survived. And thrived. And you're talking, you're talking locked facility, and so sad, but it's the way it is. And no, she didn't get away with it.
No, the man who I evaluated who had killed his six-year-old daughter is still in the Connecticut state. By the way, these state hospitals for the criminally insane are literally under the aegis of the state correctional system.
Right,
they are. They are not just hospitals. They are part of the whole penal system.
That's right. They sure are. Yeah. Well, by the way, guys, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle, as you always are, Fridays 11 here on LA Talk Radio. My special guest today, one of my favorites. He's a psychiatrist, therapist, author. Been published so many times, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. And, of course, he's written so many books, fiction, nonfiction. We've featured him on the show here. Today we're talking about his latest book. It's called Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope. I invite you all to email me if you have a question at all for Dr. Rubenstein. That would be awesome. It's straighttalkdoc@gmail.com, straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. And or if you'd like to call in, cool, we'd love to hear from you. I prefer a lot of emails because they're a little more efficient, and we can help you out. The number here, though, live in Los Angeles, 323-203-0815. Now I want to get to the book, a little bit into the book and some of the cases that you discuss, which are fascinating. As I mentioned, the book's broken down into 14 case studies, so it's a chapter about an individual, each individual with a particular type of mental disorder. And the stories are, I mean, they're riveting about what these people are doing and thinking and what they get away with, which is humorous. I mean, it's, I'm not laughing at them. I'm saying, oh my God, how some of these people manage to fool society, you know, for a while. Because, you know, because there are many of the patients are very creative and they're fascinating. So can we get to some of the stories that that I picked out here?
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. There's one of your favorite stories I read. I was kind of checking out. Now, what does Dr. Rubenstein like? Which one does he like? It's about the guy named Mr. Smith, who was brought to the hospital by police. And he'd been hanging around a famous New York hotel, saying that he had plenty of money and that he wanted to rent a suite at the hotel. He looked good. He was dressed in expensive, although kind of worn-out clothing, was carrying a large briefcase and said he had a lot of money inside. So with that being said, can you sort of unravel how that story unfolded and what you discovered about this guy?
Sure. I saw this man years ago, and he has stayed with me all of this time. Mm. Mr. Smith was initially brought to the psychiatric emergency room under the appellation of John Doe. He had been found standing around outside the Hyatt Regency Hotel on Park Avenue. Mm-hmm. He was a tall, thin, almost cachectic-looking guy with huge bulging eyes and was wearing a very worn-out but what had once been, no doubt, a beautiful blue pinstriped business suit. He had a beautiful leather pebbled briefcase. It looked like it weighed about 30, 35 pounds. Whatever was inside it was stuffed to the gills with something. He was brought in by the cops for vagrancy. They wanted to know, you know, the law is that they could not just search and seizure. They could not open up his bag and look in there unless he had been doing something and the bag was in full view and suspicious. So they brought him to the psychiatric emergency room, and I ended up interviewing him. Wow. And he was a very elegant man in his speech and manner, and he had a gilded cigarette lighter. This was in the days when you could smoke in hospitals.
Right.
And he lit up a cigarette, and he had this gold cigarette case with cigarettes in it. Mm-hmm. He lit one up and began to talk to me, saying that he thinks he might want to stay in this establishment, meaning the psychiatric hospital. Hmm. And here I was interviewing him in this dilapidated little office of an emergency room in a city hospital. And he just was looking around, and he thought this was the greatest place. He thought this was heaven on earth.
Yes.
And then I said, well, you know, a stay here could be very expensive, even more so than at the Hyatt Regency. And he said, well, I'm well-funded, doctor. I'm a man of means.
Wow.
And to prove this to me, he began talking in fiscal jargon.
Yes.
He had the most sophisticated command of fiscal verbiage I'd ever heard in my life, talking about shorting stocks and options and laddering his investments and all of this. And I was just flabbergasted. There was no alcohol on his breath. His clothes were certainly ruined and dirty looking, but he held himself with a certain dignity that struck me. Hmm. And I'm going to give away some of the punchline of this story, although there's more.
Right.
Typically, I never give away the punchline. It's sort of like giving the punchline away to a joke, and this was no joke.
Yeah.
He then said, you know, I have ample funds with me here in this briefcase. And he said, by the way, you know that it's very difficult to carry large amounts of money in cash because in 1968, President Nixon, by executive order, detailed that the Mint would no longer make anything more than $100 bills. Prior to that, they'd made $1,000 bills,
yes.
And this was to prevent money laundering of
yes.
cash.
Yeah.
And he was so knowledgeable, I was blown away.
Yeah.
So he must have seen that my eyebrows rose, and I must have registered some element of doubt on my face. And I thought this guy was delusional. He was crazy. This is so absurd. He had no place to live. I was wondering, had he once been a corporate bond trader,
right.
a broker, a
yeah.
lawyer? Who knows? Anyway, he says, I can show you that I have all the funds needed for a stay. I can pay in advance a month at a time.
Wow.
And he turns around, picks up this huge briefcase off the chair, turns around, opens the top, unlatches
yeah.
it. I'm sitting behind the desk. He turns the briefcase over, and piles of packaged $100 bills, all banded, were probably $100 bills in each bundle. And
wow.
scores and scores of them went slapping and pounding down onto the desk. And the sound alone made such a thumping noise that I wheeled away from the desk. And I looked closely. The money was not green. It was yellow.
Oh, no.
And in the corner, upper right-hand corner of each top of each stacked bill
yeah.
was a picture of a locomotive. He had probably $2 to $3 million in Monopoly money.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my God. And his delusion, he really truly believed that this was fair game here. This
he
was
believed
real money.
That this yeah. could pay his way and pave his
oh.
way into this luxurious hotel known as Manhattan Psychiatric Facility.
Oh, that breaks
well,
my heart.
Well, he was to say,
oh,
I admit it, I had been wondering, did he pick up this suit from a dumpster?
Yeah.
You know, the briefcase, it looked like it came from Crouch and Fitzgerald on Madison Avenue.
Right.
On and on. I admitted him. He began thanking me for having oh. admitted him to this wonderful hotel, he asked for a room with a view.
Yes.
And to make matters even more mysterious, and here's part I won't give away, I was so fascinated by this man, I began calling around to other hospitals to find out something about him. Hmm. And I did find out
mm-hmm.
about him.
Yes.
And you have to read the book to
yeah.
learn what I
oh,
found
darn.
Out.
Oh, darn. All right, Dr. Rubenstein. All right. No, it's good. It's fascinating, guys. You do have to read the book because it's just, you know, it broke my heart when I saw this. But this guy was brilliant. He was really.
He was absolutely. He was more fiscally knowledgeable
yeah.
and more financially astute than any broker I've ever talked with.
I hear you. Guys, in case you just tuned in, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle, my special guest today, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. Stein. We're talking about his latest book, Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope. And there's 14 chapters. They're all case studies of folks that the doctor has encountered throughout his years of being an amazing psychiatrist. And fascinating stories of, you know, how a lot of people with mental disorders, you know, live their lives. And, of course, the healing that you gave to these individuals and helping readers really understand what's going on in many cases in mental illness.
I would also say, Dr. Michelle, that each story in its own way is something of a mystery. It has a core element of mystery. You know, how did this patient get to be the way he or she is?
Yes.
Why has this happened? What can be done? And there's usually some very important key
right.
to the patient's presentation that in each of these stories emerges rather quickly.
Mm.
And so in a sense, each story is a bit of a mystery story.
Yes, it is a bit of a mystery, which I love, too. And you're good at writing those, too, as well. Guys, if you want to email us here live on the air, it's straighttalkdoc@gmail.com if you have questions. We do have some questions coming in, you know, about some, you know, possible symptoms of relatives from some of the people. But I would like to get a little bit more into your book and talk about another case study, which fascinated me. They're all really, really interesting. But this is about Dr. Papalini.
Oh, yes.
Who appeared to be
Dr. Boris Papalini.
Oh, excuse me. there you go.
Boris Papalini.
He appeared to be a physician in a hospital. but actually was an imposter. And I guess he managed to get away with it for a little while. But this was great. I love this story. Can you talk about that one?
Yeah, well, you know, I was standing outside my office in the emergency room of the hospital, in the psychiatric emergency room, and I see this tall fellow walk by. He's got a stethoscope sticking out of his white coat pocket.
Yes.
He's wearing surgical green scrubs and a green surgical cap. He walks by and he goes to the elevators leading to the upstairs wards in the psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
Well, the next day I see the same fellow dressed in the same way. And on the third day, there's a knock on my door, and it's this man. And he introduces himself by saying, "Hello, I'm Dr. Boris Papalini," which I thought was strange because he's still dressed in the same surgical scrubs and cap.
Yeah.
And usually when physicians introduce themselves to each other, they don't use the appellation doctor.
Right.
You know, "Hi,
right.
I'm Boris," you know.
Yeah,
Anyway, I shook his hand, and he says, "Do you mind if I sit in for a couple of psychiatric interviews?" I said, "Not at all, but you know, what are you doing here?" So he tells me he's upstairs consulting each day on a patient with a neurologic condition.
Hmm.
And there was something about his manner that struck me as odd,
yeah.
And my index of suspicion rose immediately. Hmm. And I asked him, "Well, have you done an MRI? He mentioned some strange symptoms. And he said, "No, not yet." And then I said, "Well, how about a cystogram?"
Right.
Well, a cystogram is a study of the urinary bladder.
Yeah, right.
It has nothing
to do
with the brain or central
right.
nervous system, but
right.
this fellow didn't know that. He said, "Not yet," so I knew he wasn't a physician.
Right.
I went outside, and I got two huge, hulking security guards.
Hmm.
By the way, this was in the days before all hospital personnel were required to wear badges with their pictures on them.
Mm-hmm.
This was back in the early 80s. And they came in, and I then began grilling him, somewhat gently but aggressively.
Yeah, sure.
Where did you go to medical school? He said, "Oh, well, at Bellevue." I said, "Well, Bellevue's a hospital. It's not a medical school." You know. And a few more questions, and it mm-hmm. became very obvious. And then he said, the guards approached him. He stood up and said, "Don't you touch me." And one guard grabbed them by the wrist. The other one grabbed the other wrist, and they tied his hands behind his back with
Whoops.
A tie back.
Yeah.
And he began protesting vehemently. He said, "I only need to consult with my assistant," and I noticed a bulge in the right pocket.
Wait
of his
for it, everybody. Wait for it. It's
I
coming.
I noticed this bulge, and an electric shock went through him. I said, "This guy, he had a gun." And turns out that he keeps insisting he wants to talk to his assistant, and at some point there's movement in the pocket, and lo and behold, about 30 seconds later, the head of a hamster peeks out from the pocket.
Oh, my God.
This guy's assistant was a brown hamster.
Oh, God bless him.
Well, I don't have to tell you he was admitted.
You think?
He had, and then I spoke with the attending upstairs once he'd been admitted the next day, and it turned out this fellow had been masquerading around the hospital for many, many days, going to different departments and sitting in on examinations. And I don't know if he did actually end up examining patients.
Mm.
What really was frightening about it was that a couple of years later, and this was not Dr. Boris Papalini, it was someone else.
Yes.
A woman at Bellevue Hospital, a physician, was raped and murdered one night by a homeless man who had been posing as a physician in the hospital.
Oh,
he'd been living on the 23rd floor of the hospital in a little alcove behind some storage room where they stored equipment.
Right?
He had been filching food off hospital trays that were discarded and had gone down to the laundry and gotten a doctor's garb, you know, dirty surgical scrubs and a coat, and was masquerading around the hospital.
Oh,
well, the police found him very quickly living only a few blocks away in a homeless shelter when two other homeless men called the police because this made huge news in New York City. And he was found to have this woman's credit cards and her coat in his possession.
Wow.
So that was
scary.
The end of that case.
Oh,
that
my
was
goodness.
Not Boris Papalini, but it and soon after that, all hospitals began to require that every employee wear a photo ID badge.
Yes.
And that's been the case up until today.
Oh, what a fascinating story. I mean, that is scary. That's downright
scary.
It
was close to the edge. I mean, this could have happened with this man. You never know.
Yeah, yeah. And the hamster was just, whoa. I read that in your book, and I went, oh, my goodness. That's something else. Guys, you're on the couch here with Dr. Michelle, and we're talking about one of my favorite guests, of course, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, and his latest book, which is Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope, 14 chapters of case studies to help you understand, you know, various folks and their mental illness issues. And you hear me chuckle sometimes, but this is serious. This is devastating to people around the individuals who suffer from these disorders. And of course, we're trying to demystify, you know, mental illness here on the show as well. The book's an excellent read. Also has a lot of terminology to help you understand. There's a lot of case studies explaining to you what needs to happen sort of to help unravel and figure out why these people are suffering from what they are. A couple of case studies I want to get to real fast here because we're always in a hurry on the show because we have so much information that's great from you always. I wanted to find out about that case study, which really was fascinating, about the woman. And we've heard about body dysmorphic disorder, but this is something completely else. This is the woman who thought she needed many surgeries, but she was physically healthy. So what made her persuade these surgeons to operate on her more than a dozen times if she was healthy? What was that about?
Well, this is what technically it's called a polysurgery. People call it Munchausen syndrome.
Yes.
But Munchausen people tend to fabricate their symptoms, mm-hmm. and, for instance, they will rub the thermometer against the blanket of the hospital bed to give themselves a so-called fever.
Yes.
This woman was not faking anything. She felt genuine pain. And she had all kinds of abdominal symptoms, breathing difficulties. Mm. She had a long, her chart was a few feet thick at the hospital over the years.
Wow.
She had been opened up many times. In those days, they did what were called laparoscopies.
Right.
They did full-blown open laparotomies, which is
right.
opening the belly. In those days, they hadn't yet perfected laparoscopy, where they make a small incision, stick a laparoscopic tube in, and look with a mini camera and light.
Right.
Where, you can walk out of the hospital either later that day or early the next morning. It's
right.
not major surgery. So this woman, she had what we call a checkerboard abdomen, which is the result of scar tissue having formed in crisscross cuts because of so many surgeries having been done on her abdomen.
Mm. Wow.
Make a long story short, it turns out I was asked to evaluate her because the chief resident, surgical resident, thought that there was something very strange about her. They had not been able to find a single pathologic thing other than adhesions, which of course form after multiple surgeries and can cause a blockage of the intestines. They can cause obstruction. And she had a few of those, which of course were legitimate surgeries to lyse or melt off the adhesions.
Right.
Anyway, I sat down and talked with her, and it was a very illuminating discussion. I learned something about her. She had been a twin.
Okay.
She had an identical twin sister who died at 5 years of age.
Mm.
And the doctor who kept coming to examine her and her mother, who was very concerned, in those days doctors made house calls when she was a kid, said, this child is sick so often, she's really sick enough for two.
Yes.
She's sick enough for her twin sister
Aww.
As well as herself.
Right.
the bottom line was that what emerged on a dynamic basis in terms of her psychodynamics, her psychological makeup, was that she felt, and was completely unaware of it, survivor's guilt for having survived her twin sister.
Oh my gosh.
And I get into an entire discussion of twinship and what it means and how these people can have difficulties self-individuating and how they really see themselves as part of a dyad, a duo of two. And there, too, I'm not going to give away the punchline, if you will, or the bottom line of the story, because something very dramatic happened. But this is a woman who, in her presentation, was sort of, in one ball of wax, was condensing a lifetime of guilt for having survived, was using her body in a completely unconscious, unwillful way to enact out all her guilt and the loss of her sister, and was living a miserable, lonely life and suffering terribly physically as well as emotionally because of something happened when she was five, and who was living a life of surgery.
Oh my gosh.
Again, something very dramatic happened happens toward the end of the story, which I won't reveal for fear of ruining the story.
Right.
But it's another mystery as to what can happen, what can go wrong, where hospitals... you know, it's the old story. In the old days, when a patient complained enough about pain, and you did it enough and came frequently enough, you would get opened up.
Right, you know, exactly. Yeah, doctors, we got to find out what's going on.
Yeah, you get sued for negligence if you don't take the proper steps when somebody's complaining of severe pain.
That's right.
So her pain was psychogenic. It was not faked. It was not. She was not malingering. She was not looking for attention. She was looking to expiate guilt.
Oh, my gosh. Good heaven. And it never would help until... Dr. Rubenstein got to her, of course. It never helped. It never did. She come to understand? Well, I guess I'm doing the spoiler alert, aren't I?
Yeah, there's a spoiler alert here. Yeah, the red flag just went up. What happened was very dramatic and not terribly unexpected in a way. I think people will appreciate the story more if they get to it on their own.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree with you. You're funny. We're moving on, talking about Dr. Mark Rubenstein, his latest book, of course. It's called Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope. 14 chapters, 14 case studies, outlining a lot of really fascinating cases that Dr. Mark has really worked with. And some of the, you know, how to help these people with the outcome. Fascinating stories. And in a minute, we're also going to talk about how you can find out more about Dr. Rubenstein and also his other books, which are great reads, fiction and nonfiction. I enjoyed the story, and I was thinking about the old TV show The Sopranos when I read this one. You know what I'm going to be talking about. It's that sort of funny encounter involves, and the only way I could say it is like my Brooklyn relatives, Joey P., who comes to you because he's having difficulty interacting with his father in the family business. And can you tell us about that business and sort of what happened with Joey?
Well, Joey P. was a garrulous guy, about 30 years old. He was still living at home with his mother and father, which I thought back then was very unusual. It's not like the millennials today who have to come home, you know,
because
they can't get a job. I shouldn't be laughing.
That's true.
You know, he was 30 years old. He spoke in that Brooklyn patois from the streets and was an Italian kid who I felt a great affinity for him because I myself came from Brooklyn, and I knew many, many guys who he reminded me of.
Right.
And he was outlining to me how terrible it is working for and with his father, and the business is, he just feels so emasculated. His father puts him down in front of all his associates and this and that and the other thing. And he goes on to tell me that his father, they're in the refuse removal business. They have a couple of other restaurant linens. I'm putting two and two together, and I say, well, yeah, this guy is in some way connected. Well, you know, he comes in. It turns out he's a very dependent young man. He says, why should I move out of the house? I got three. It's great there, you know.
Yeah.
My mother does the laundry. She's a great cook, you know.
Yeah.
And he earns a good living, but, you know, he's saving his money. Bottom line, he comes in after about 3 months of once weekly sessions. I'm trying to help him see a bit more about his relationship to his mother and father and his dependency. Mm-hmm. And I figure it's a very focused kind of therapy, and I don't have to know anything else about what his family does for the name of the story, I think, if I recall, is The Family and Me.
Right.
And he comes in, and he looks at me in a strange way and says, "Hey, Doc, you want to know who clipped Carmine Galenti?"
No, no, he didn't. Oh,
only
God.
A couple of days before, very well-known gangster mobster named Carmine Galenti was having lunch in an outdoor patio in Joe and Mary's Italian restaurant on Knickerbocker Avenue in Brooklyn when three gunmen went into the restaurant, passed through the entire place, came out on the back patio, and blew
Whacked
Carmine
him.
Galenti and his two Sicilian bodyguards away.
Oh,
it was really the work of the Colombo or the Gambino family.
Yes.
And it had been all over the news. It was a huge story in New York and probably nationally.
Yeah.
The most amazing thing about it was that Carmine Galenti was shot through the eye and had lots of holes in his chest, and he was propped up against a low brick wall, dead as a doornail, the proverbial doornail,
right.
And sticking out of his middle name was the nickname Cigar. He was Carmine Cigar Galenti.
Yes.
And sticking out of his clenched dead teeth was a lit stogie still smoking.
Oh, God.
And this was a photograph in the Daily News, the New York Post, and everywhere. It's available online. You
can see
it anytime you want. And I was faced with a dilemma. First of all, I didn't want to know who clipped Carmine Galenti. And secondly, it suddenly dawned on me that Joey P. was a very talkative guy. He had a big mouth, and I had no idea what he might be telling his father or his father's associates.
Oh, yeah.
Not only didn't I not want to know who clipped Carmine Galenti, I didn't want to have anything anymore to do with Joey P. Now, this was in the days long before Dr. Melfi and Tony Soprano made it onto the, the air.
That's right.
And I was faced with the dilemma, what does any therapist do when he or she suddenly realizes that a violent crime has been committed, and what legal, ethical, professional obligations do you have?
I'm
not going to really say what happened after that, but I was faced with a scary dilemma, and I had to keep looking over my shoulder.
Oh, I bet. Did they have Tarasoff back then? Did they have the Tarasoff?
Tarasoff ruling occurred years before, I believe in the 60s, and the Tarasoff ruling was that you, as a mental health professional, if you learned that a crime was imminent, about to be committed, not one that had been committed, but that was imminent, you had a duty to report the nature of that plan, of that potential crime, to the potential victim.
Yes.
And that to not do so, you could be found negligent, and you could be held basically as someone who is you're in collusion.
Yeah.
Before the fact, not after
the
fact, before the fact, and that could be a criminal offense. Now, what happened with Joey P. was I learned of this. I didn't learn the name of the person who had, or the people who had done this.
Yes.
But I was learning of a crime, and I had access to information about who had committed the crime after the fact, after it had gone down.
And we are not legally bound to report that.
I was not legally bound to notify anybody, the police, an attorney. But I didn't know what to do, so I had to make arrangements to find out what to do, and what I ended up doing is really the punchline or the bottom line of the story. But it was a scary scenario, and it taught me a lot about psychotherapy also, because I realized that no matter how you distance yourself, you know, in the transference from a patient. No matter how, you don't enter into a patient's life. You know, you don't lend the money.
Yeah, sure.
You don't have sex with the patient. You don't have a social relationship with the patient. Still, you end up becoming part of a patient's life. They tell you the most intimate things about their thoughts, their feelings, and their activities.
Mm-hmm.
And like it or not, you do end up becoming, in some symbolic way, if nothing else, part of that person's life. And
right,
that can
suck
you into a deep, dark spiral of a hole.
Can it ever? And you don't want to know, because you don't want to be fingered for, you know, ooh, this guy knows. So, I mean, it's frightening. It really is.
Yeah. I preceded Dr. Melfi by a couple of decades.
Oh, I bet. I bet you did. And you, yeah. Well, listen.
I also end up thinking about the fabulously funny film with Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal.
Oh,
Analyze
God.
This.
Yeah, that's the best. You know, that's the best. Listen, we're running out of time. How can listeners find out more about you and get your latest book, Bedlam's Door: True Stories of Madness and Hope?
The easiest way of access, and really the cheapest if you have a Kindle or a Kindle app, is to just go on Amazon. It's, it's all of $4.99. And go to Amazon and type in Bedlam's Door. That's all you have to type in. You don't even have to type in the subtitle, and it'll come up. They can go to my website, which is markrubenstein-author.com. That's markrubenstein-author.com. The book is also available in bookstores, but it's a lot cheaper if you can get the electronic version. I think it's $12.95 in paper. But it's available. It's all around, and Psychology Today did an interview and a feature of so did Gizmodo. And
you have so many reviews online of your great book. Man, it's, you just pull it up, and it's there's about 12 reviews I was reading online.
Of Bedlam, right now there are 33, and it's growing every day. So, you know, and I think it's got a 4.8 star average, which,
hey.
Give me 4.8 stars, I'm happy.
Hey, there you go. As always, a pleasure to have you on the show, Mark. Such a pleasure.
My pleasure,
you
Michelle.
You just help my listeners so much, and really, I appreciate all of your books. Dr. Mark Rubenstein, and again, folks, you can go online. I'm going to have the archives up on the air tomorrow, so you can replay this interview if you missed anything, and check out his book. It's a really good read, I'm telling you. Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope. And also, Dr. Rubenstein, I want you back on the show to talk about True Tales from the Couch and Courtroom. Coming out
that's
in May.
Coming in May. Yeah. By the way, Bedlam's Door is also available for those who like or prefer Audible. It just came out two weeks ago as an Audible, and when I hear somebody reading my own words, it sounds so strange.
It does, but it sounds good. He's a good narrator.
Oh yeah, the guy who narrates is a fabulous actor named Tim Campbell, and he's really great. I mean, I couldn't believe he acts out all the voices and accents and everything else. It's just amazing.
He's super. Hey, listen, happy holidays. Thank you so much for being
too,
here.
Michelle. Be All well. Right. Take care. We'll talk again.
All righty. Take care, Dr. Rubenstein. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. As always, a great interview with Dr. Rubenstein. Mark Rubenstein, the books are available at Amazon or, of course, his website, markrubenstein-author.com. Thanks for being on the couch with me today. This is Dr. Michelle Cohen, back next week with more great information about improving your life and your self-esteem, helping you with some unresolved issues you may be having. That's me. As I always say, take care of yourself first, and you'll be great for others. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye now. Flashing red.